From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. We have had a lot of coverage in the last couple of months of gun control issues in Vermont and triggered by the Jack Sawyer case down in Rutland County. This is the young man who was allegedly threatening to shoot up his former high school in Fairhaven. We passed a bunch of laws in Vermont relating to gun control. Vermont went from a state with some of the least strict gun regulations in the country to probably somewhere in the middle in terms of how we are regulating gun ownership and access to firearms, all that sort of thing. And now the Jack Sawyer case seems to be, as the Burlington Free Press put it in a headline yesterday, falling apart to some extent anyway. The felony charges went away this week. There are questions about whether the remaining misdemeanor charges are going to be able to be, whether they're going to stick. And so we wanted to sort of look at the other end of this case and find out whether perhaps the matter was overplayed from the beginning. And then we have to ask really what the political ramifications of that might have been. Did we generally overplay the hand altogether over the past couple of months here in Vermont? Obviously, context matters. We had that horrible school shooting that did happen in Parkland, Florida in mid-February, and it was just a day or so later that Mr. Sawyer was arrested and was charged with planning a similar event at the Fairhaven Union High School. Joining me this morning to talk about these issues is Matt Valerio. He's the longtime Defender General of the state of Vermont. And good morning, Matt. Thanks for joining the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to ask you first off, tell us a little bit about kind of where the case stands. We had some court action this week, and some charges were dropped. A few remain. Tell us, update us on where that stands.
Well, I think consistent with what the Supreme Court had directed in a bail review motion earlier in the month, the state's attorney in Rutland County saw the writing on the wall and dismissed the felony charges. In the interim, there had been a couple of misdemeanor charges that were filed. I know that bail is still in place. I actually believe today there is a hearing on bail relative to the misdemeanor charges. And, you know, there may well be a resolution of the case in very short order.
And I wonder whether, you know, back in the beginning of this case, I think everyone, certainly in the media, and myself included, I was on the program here talking about this as if it was a real legitimate threat against the community of Fairhaven and the young people who go to school there and so on and so forth. And now there are questions about sort of how serious this young man was and how worried folks really needed to be. I mean, a lot of people write horrible things in journals. You know, I heard someone say yesterday that if you'd ever read some of Stephen King's writings and just thought about what he might do based on what he was describing, he'd gone to jail a long time ago. And of course, instead, he's a famous writer living up in Maine and has a number of great novels to his, or at least widely read novels to his credit. And so we had a case where this horrible shooting happened in Florida. Obviously, we've had a spate really in the last 20 years. I think just last week was the 20th anniversary of the Columbine shooting in Colorado. And so school shootings have been very much in people's minds during this period. And then we have this case in Florida, another case like Columbine, a little worse. I think in Columbine, 13 young people died. And in Parkland, Florida, it was 17. And then we had this sort of near miss, as people were calling it, in good old Fairhaven, Vermont. And Governor Phil Scott came out immediately afterward and said his views on gun control, gun regulation, et cetera, had changed pretty much 180 degrees. He said that he had thought up until now that such a thing just couldn't happen in Vermont, that we were somehow immune. And but he said he can no longer look in the mirror and say that to himself anymore. So he was open to gun control legislation, and sure enough, the legislature followed suit. And so we have a much changed picture in terms of gun regulation in Vermont since just mid-February. And I am not here right now saying whether that's necessarily all a good thing or all a bad thing. I think what's remarkable here, though, is the way that these big political changes were built on a case which, as I mentioned, the Free Press said yesterday and others have observed similarly, doesn't seem to be holding up in court very well, at least compared to what it was at the beginning. So, Matt, tell me your view of this thing was this an overreaction in a sense?
Well, I said from day one that in just reading the affidavit and the information that supported the charges that the case was overcharged. And that was just a point of legal analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But perception becomes reality in these kinds of cases. None of these things you can look at out of context when it comes to the response. You know, Jack Sawyer was a kid who was known to people in Fairhaven for quite some time, and even known to law enforcement. But it wasn't until the context of Parkland kind of bubbled everything to the surface that that action was taken. And in fact, you know, not very long before the charges were even brought, there was a question of whether charges should be brought, and law enforcement indicated they didn't have anything to go on. There wasn't enough there for charges. So that standing alone, then combined with Parkland and combined maybe with the upcoming anniversary of Columbine and the not distant past of Sandy Hook and the
Las
like,
Vegas and Orlando,
you know, it puts us in a position where we are hypersensitive to these things. And I have to say, too, that, you know, when the media gets a hold of these things, we now have a 24/7 media cycle.
Sure.
And there have been, since this case started, I've probably been getting no less than 10 calls a day from various media sources wanting the next spin, the next shade on the case, whatever it might be. And it's not just, you know, now we want one story that we can run in the paper the next day, but we want three different stories that we can post online on our website, you know, whether it's AP, Vermont Digger, you know, Rutland Herald, Burlington Free Press, whoever it is.
Yeah.
And it's all of those times three. So people are inundated with this. It becomes very overwhelming.
That's an entirely different program or perhaps series of programs sometime on this show. We have this glut of information out there now and glut of news and news coverage going on. And you do have to wonder sometimes whether it's just, frankly, too much, whether we're kind of drowning in information about whatever the current hot story is.
You know, well, if you're inundated with it, you feel the pressure of that when you're calling, you know, how do you emotionally respond to this? How are we going to politically respond to it? How do we respond to it legally? I think it's probably naive to think that the citizens of the state, the judges, the legislators, of course, are going to, you know, act in a vacuum.
Yeah.
It's all as part of this context of information that is being presented to them.
I want to make sure that listeners remember that we invite them to call in. Any questions or comments about this case, related issues to the recent gun control legislation or to the way the political system in Vermont has reacted to these events. And you're welcome to call us at 244-1777. That's the local number here in Waterbury. And the toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. 291-8255. And while we're doing house business, I should also say, if you can hear some of this program this morning, but not the whole thing, because you have to go to a dentist appointment or something, you are more than welcome to go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show, and you will find a list of our podcasts from the time, I think the time I started broadcasting here in late February. So you can Go check it out. You can listen anytime, 24 hours a day, if you like, online. That's the great thing about that podcast technology that's now available to all of us. We have Rich on the phone from Huntington. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, this overreaction wasn't just on the part of prosecutors here bringing these charges. Mm-hmm. We had a subsequent overreaction by our own governor who just took the bait and swam with it. You know, this was a big league overreaction based on his own words that he was concerned about this threat of this Jack Sawyer, which now we're finding out is going to bring what I would consider kind of minor misdemeanor charges. So there's major egg on the governor's face here, and he knows it, and he knows he's looking silly over this whole thing. Now, you know, the legislature, they were going to bring a gun bill and try to get it to his desk, but when he waved them on in, they embellished it with all the goodies that they wanted to put on it, and he just took it hook, line, and sinker. And now we're left with this guy who's going to be set free. Sure, there are going to be conditions on him, but you know what? He's going to walk out of this thing without even a felony conviction, and then without a felony conviction, free of any other court orders, he could walk right back into Dick's and buy another shotgun and pass the federal background check.
That is an interesting point there. Matt, do you have any, do you regard that as the facts of the matter here? I mean, will he be able to get firearms in the future?
Well, he won't be able to do that immediately because there is one of the things the legislature passed early on was this, there was basically an order, there's now an order in place, a civil order, preventing him from being able to purchase or possess firearms. And it was something actually that he agreed to. I'm not sure that under the facts that were presented, he would have been prevented from doing that, but he consented to it. So as of right now, he wouldn't be able to purchase a gun.
Got it. Okay. Rich, thanks for the call. We're going to move on to Matt from Williston. What's going on, Matt?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're aware, but there was a school shooting last week in Ocala, Florida, and it barely raised a blip on the screen. Because the school resource officer did his job. The gentleman didn't use an AR-15 or an assault rifle. He didn't have a high-capacity magazine. He did, however, bring in a illegal sawed-off shotgun in a guitar case. He used it in a gun-free zone. The kids were locked down. He shot under a door, and a BB hit a kid in the ankle, and that was the extent of it. But right. We didn't see this 24-hour nonstop, you know, here's what happened, here's how it happened, and so forth. So it just seems like there is an agenda out there by the media to fit a narrative that they want. And it's getting very tiresome. And then this case in the state of Vermont with this Jack Sawyer, the legislator spent a lot of time on S-55. This kid's had mental health issues for a while. And instead of spending time on our opiate crisis and on mental health issues, we wasted a lot of energy and capital making it harder for law-abiding citizens to go about their way. And again, restricting our Article 15 of our Constitution and our ability to defend ourselves.
Well, yeah, I just want to mention your first point about the media coverage. I was aware of the shooting last week in Ocala, Florida. And I think what happens is, you know, in most newsrooms, editors, reporters will look at a situation where in one case you have 17 people dead. That's the Parkland case. In another case, you have a kid getting hit in the ankle with a BB. And I think you sort of cover the stuff really. I mean, one of the key factors in most newsroom decision making is, you know, did anybody die? And if so, how many people died? And, you know, it used to be that that we and the media are often still accused of playing up deaths that are closer to home. So two people dying in your town is a front page story. You know, 1,000 people dying in an earthquake in Asia is probably page C3 in your newspaper. And so, and there's even a term for that in media studies classes. They call it Afghanistanism. As in the old days, it used to be if the event occurred in Afghanistan, it got buried deep inside the paper. So, I do think there's some proportionality here.
That's all well and good, but our governor wasn't talking about who died when they used that as a reason for passing S-55 and using this gun legislation. What they said, it was school safety. They didn't define, you know, whether someone's going to die or not. It's about school safety and kids feeling safe. So if some kid can walk into a high school or any person with a weapon or whatever else they want to use, I mean, the point of S-55 was it was supposed to make everything safer, and it's not going to do that. It's a false sense of security, and that's even worse.
Well, you know, I actually did some research on this when this first started. I could see the rumbling clouds coming, and as anybody could. And I tried to do some research on school shootings over a period of time. And interestingly enough, the rate of school shootings has actually declined over the last 30 years, not increased. The number of casualties that have occurred in recent shootings is high, but the incidents themselves are much lower than they were in the 70s and 80s. You know, there is, the caller has some perspective on how our perception of things is shaping reality.
Well, we're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV and be back. Thanks for the call, Matt in Williston, and we're going to go to a break and be back with Matt Valerio, the Defender General, very shortly.
Hi, this is Jim Spencer. As president of Kinney Drugs, I happen to think we're very special. Kinney has supported our local community since 1903, and that means a lot to our employee owners. So if you're thinking about switching to a new pharmacy, Kinney Drugs would love to have you. That's why I'm inviting you to visit your hometown Kinney. There's no need to get new prescriptions. Just call or bring them in, and our pharmacist will take it from there. See you soon.
Is your small business networked properly? Ormsby's Computer Systems can help. Putting your IT planning in the hands of a trusted partner and letting them do what they do best lets you do what you do best. Ormsby's Computer Systems on the Barry Montpelier Road. Ormsby'sComputer.com.
As representatives of Vernon, Patty O'Donnell and I have safeguarded the future of our town by making sure that important decisions are made in the best interest of all members of our community.
That's why Josh Unruh, the entire Select Board of Vernon, and I are united in supporting the sale of Entergy's Vermont Yankee site to Northstar Group Services for decommissioning.
With Northstar's expertise in decommissioning, the Vermont Yankee buildings can be removed and a majority of the property restored by 2030.
That's decades earlier than originally planned. You see, the restoration of this land is not about Entergy or Northstar. It's about Vernon.
It's about our future and the future of the children in our community, because they'll be the ones most benefiting from the decisions we make today.
Learn more about why many members of our community support the plan to decommission Vermont Yankee decades sooner. Visit vydecommissioning.com.
This is Greg Haskin, president of Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom. These days, every major service provider relies on the same technology. What makes us different is how our people work with the customers that rely on it. Here's Lee Cheney, Central Office Manager.
When customers call in, we listen, we hear them, and we do the best to meet their needs, and they don't call into deaf ears. You know, we jump on it. We go right out and meet with the customers. We're a local company. They're not talking to anybody down in Boston or New York. They're talking to somebody right here in Waitsfield. And that home feeling and that local feeling is important to people. We don't just work to solve our needs for the community. We work with the community to give them back some of the things that they need. And we enjoy doing that. We're local. Come on in. We'll talk to you. And we'll figure it out.
At Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom, we know that the way to be your telecommunications provider is to give you world-class customer service. For over a century, that's a challenge we've welcomed every single day.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Here's Dave.
And we are back, continuing our conversation with Defender General Matt Valerio about the recent school shootings, the threat in Fairhaven back in February, the resulting legislation. I wanted to ask you, Matt, you mentioned a moment ago that there was some discussion, I guess, in the law enforcement circles about possibly bringing charges against Mr. Sawyer before that actually happened. And then Parkland happened, and then this alleged threat occurred, I guess. And walk through that sequence there.
Well, you know, what I'm aware of is that, you know, Mr. Sawyer was known to Fairhaven high school officials and to law enforcement, and there was, you know, there were some concerns expressed some months before, some weeks before, and even during time frames when, you know, before he had gone to Maine to school. And, you know, law enforcement, and I don't know if there was consultation with the state's attorney or not, declined to bring charges because they were not sure that they had enough to do it. But I think the thing that changed the conversation was Parkland. Parkland occurred, and it was very much on the minds of everybody. And as a result, you know, I think that out of an abundance of caution, and probably too much caution, as we're seeing, charges were brought.
And so these charges are brought, and they end up basically not sticking. But in the interim between the charges being brought and the and being dropped, the felony charges anyway, we have major changes in Vermont. And so let's talk a little bit about the political reaction here. What do you make of all? What do you make of like that overall arc of history that occurred over the past couple of months?
Well, we have a history of doing this in Vermont. If you go all the way back to 1980 in the Hamlin and Savage cases up in Burlington, the rape and murder of one girl and rape of another, those cases brought the Vermont legislature back in
special session. Right?
Special session during the summer, and we changed the way we handled juvenile cases and made Vermont an outlier for 40 years as to how we handle 16 and 17-year-old cases. And then as a result of the Jakes case in the during the Douglas administration, all of the...
This is the killing of Brooke Bennett, who was Brooke 12 Bennett. Years old by, I guess, her uncle, right?
Right. Yeah. And he, in that situation, we came in and like immediately changed the sex offender laws in Vermont. And in this case, we have a very similar immediate sort of knee-jerk reaction. But this time, nothing actually had happened. And there were, you know, no... we didn't even wait for the case to end.
Yeah. It is kind of an amazing sequence of events here. And I want to talk about more about the political reaction and sort of how to think about this. After we return, we're going to be going to a little break at the bottom of the hour for our CBS News update. And when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Matt Valerio of he's the Chief Defender General. He is the Defender General for the state of Vermont and heads up the public defender system and knows a lot about Vermont's criminal justice system. We will be back very shortly.
CBS News Update. The president's travel ban takes center stage in Washington in a half an hour.
I'm Stephen Portnoy at the Supreme Court. The ban's been before judges since the first days of Donald Trump's presidency. But for the first time, the Supreme Court today hears arguments on the merits. The Justice Department's lawyer says the president has the power to bar entry to any class of aliens if he deems it in the national interest. The White House says the travel ban is necessary to ensure proper vetting. But pointing to the president's own words, opponents will argue it's based on anti-Muslim animus, violating the First Amendment.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is weighing in. Correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
In a statement, Sessions said the president determined the travel ban is critical to protecting the American people. The ban prohibits travelers from several mostly Muslim countries from entering the U.S. It also targets North Korea and government officials of Venezuela and their families. Opponents say it's discriminatory.
That's Steve Dorsey, CBS News Update. I'm Deborah Rodriguez.
McMahon Chevy Buick is home to one of the largest inventories of new Chevy trucks in New England. Hi, I'm Dan Keene, proud owner of McMahon. We've got over 100 Chevy trucks in stock and incoming, and we're making deals. In fact, you can lease a brand new 2018 Chevy Colorado at McMahon for only $199 a month.
Hi, I'm Steve Sason at McMahon. You heard Dan right. At McMahon Chevy Buick, with only $2,900 down, plus all fees, current GM leasees can lease a brand new 2018 Chevy Colorado Extended Cab for only $199 a month. And these are some gorgeous trucks. This is a 39-month lease with 10,000 miles a year. We also have some great deals on Silverados. And because we're doing so many truck deals, McMahon has a huge selection of clean, low-mileage used vehicles in stock, including McMahon's Import Corner. We are McMahon Chevy Buick on Route 15 between the roundabouts in Morrisville and Hyde Park, and at McMahonChevrolet.com.
So there it is, folks. At McMahon, you can get a lease on a new 2018 Chevy Colorado for only $199 a month.
Driven to be the best.
Come see us today, and remember, at McMahon Chevy Buick, we know price matters.
We're all aging, so we might as well laugh about it. The Central Vermont Council on Aging presents a benefit performance of Age Out Loud, featuring NPR award-winning comedic storytellers Suzanne Schmidt and Kevin Gallagher, with special guest Willem Lang and live music by The Brevity Thing, Friday, May 4th at the Barry Opera House. Sponsored in part by Green Mountain Support Associates, National Life Group, and you. Come and support your local Central Vermont Council on Aging. Tickets at Barry Opera House.
Why do I love to teach? I love creating a classroom where my students feel warm and nurtured, learn to work together, and treat each other with kindness regardless of outward differences. I love watching them develop an enthusiasm for learning that will take them through life and give them the skills to do the things that they want to do as adults. I love knowing that I am making a difference. My name is Nora Skolnick. I teach at Randolph Elementary School, and that is why I love to teach.
Brought to you by the women and men of Vermont NEA.
Stop! Hold on! Wait a minute! Before you sign your name on the dotted line, please give me, Ed Farr, and the Autosaver Group's Capital City Buick GMC sales team in Montpelier a chance to show you how much money you can save by shopping here. For example, your choice of $10,000 off any brand new 17 upfitted HD truck or any new all-wheel drive Buick Encore for $24,500, it's your choice. The savings don't stop there. Our entire pre-owned inventory, including GM certified, are all priced online for immediate sale. We're stacking them deep and we're selling them cheap. Capital City Buick GMC stocks over 500 new Buicks and GMC trucks, so we are bound to have the exact truck for you. Let me be clear, we will bend over backwards, so hurry in now. If your car already has a Capital City sticker on the back of it, the entire staff here says thank you. We are located 1 mile from the roundabout in Montpelier. Capital City Buick GMC and GMC trucks, we are professional grade.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing our conversation with Defender General Matt Valerio. I wanted to ask you, Matt, was there probable cause to the charge? Judge Zone issued a show cause order to reconsider his decision finding probable cause. If no probable cause, then is there potential legal liability against the police and prosecutor?
It's interesting. The first element of a malicious prosecution case is a dismissal for lack of probable cause. Maybe there was some consideration that if the case were dismissed for lack of probable cause as opposed to dismissed by the state, that might change something. I don't know. My office doesn't do any of that. That's something that's left to the private bar or others. So it's not really any consideration of ours, except for the fact that, I am aware that for malicious prosecution, the first element is dismissal for lack of probable cause.
Because, this really sounds kind of weird. The more we look into it now, to say that there was discussion about perhaps charging Sawyer before Parkland, and then Parkland happens, and afterward, now we're going to charge him. To what extent did the facts change on the ground in Vermont or maybe New York State, where the police allegedly got a report from this young woman who was a friend of his?
Yeah, well, I don't want to go into the specific facts of the case as charged, because there's still a pending charge. I definitely think, however, that the context of the information that law enforcement had and prosecution had changed. Parkland changed... changed the narrative completely.
And the new misdemeanor charges filed this week Is there probable cause for those? This is carrying a firearm with intent, I believe, and there was another one involving threatening, right?
There is, yes. You know, that again is a pending case. I'm going to leave that to the lawyers who are representing Mr. Sawyer from our office and from the court. In fact, they're going to be in court today. It's not really appropriate to discuss that. There is clearly some question about whether those charges are going to hang together as well.
Okay. One of the questions in this case, really, and this figured a lot in the April 11th Supreme Court decision on whether Mr. Sawyer could continue to be held without bail. The difference between alleged planning of a crime and attempting a crime, and we've talked about that at some length on this show in the past couple of weeks, because obviously the court found that to be a key distinction. And I thought one of the cases that was cited in the court ruling of the 11th was almost sort of funny. There was a case, I think, where somebody, this is back in 1906 or something, where a guy is in prison and a friend of his apparently comes by and throws hacksaw blades through the open window. I guess there were bars over this open window, but you could throw a package of hacksaw blades through the bars into his friend who's in jail. And the obvious crime was going to be attempted escape, because I guess this guy was supposed to take the hacksaw blades and start sawing away and try to escape. I could only imagine then maybe one of the guards in the prison coming by and seeing this and saying, did you saw what I see? But there was a case where this guy didn't actually start sawing the bars from inside the prison. He had the tools. Apparently there was a plan. He didn't actually start sawing the bars. And so that case said, turned on this fact that he never attempted that crime of escape, right?
Correct.
So, and the court found that that was similar to this case, where even if you could prove that he was planning something, and, you know, I think it's, there are some questions now about whether this journal was more of a fictional thing or some kind of an artifact of mental health therapy he was getting, or some other, that it wasn't just a cookbook for a big crime. It could have been something else. And so if that might have been the case, then there's a real question in my mind about whether you even are really planning a crime. But assuming you are, he never got to the attempt. I mean, I always picture attempt as something like you actually shoot at somebody and miss. That would be maybe attempted murder.
Correct.
So walk me through this. Tell me what you're...
Yeah. Well, see, Vermont is actually, and most of the eastern part of the country, is based on common law crimes and defenses.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a common law attempt statute that goes back well over 100 years. The statute, nobody has ever found it to be deficient. Nobody has ever complained about it. Nobody ever has seen it as being a problem until this case, because the facts didn't fit the result that some people wanted. In this situation, I see the attempt statute as not being the problem. Really, it is the development of the evidence over time just didn't fit a crime. Now, there are some other nuances to this. If you go out west, they have model penal code type of attempt statutes. Under Vermont law, however, if you are convicted of attempt, you get punished as though you actually committed the crime.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out west, under the attempt statutes there, in some of the model penal code states, and there are degrees of this, mm-hmm. but the penalty tends to be half of what it would be if you actually committed the crime.
I see.
But the standard to prove attempt is a little bit lower. And there are lots of shades of gray in between, the common law and a pure model penal code that get you to, you know, various levels of culpability, depending upon what state you're in. Some states use model penal code language, but interpret it exactly like Vermont's.
I see. Huh. We have a caller on the line, John from Chelsea. Good morning, John.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Hey, the Defender General's Office provides an invaluable service. And I want to thank them for that. I don't know how many people they serve each year, but it's incredibly important that everybody has the option of using them. And I want to thank them for that. I do want to bring up something unrelated to this case, but I think you opened the floor to just general conversations about the Defender General's office.
Mm-hmm.
I see two faults within their system. I've actually been in contact with them about these. One is that they don't track individual hours on individual cases, so they don't really know what level of support a defendant might be getting. And then the second thing is that there's no mandatory obligation for the lawyers to contact the people they're representing. I'm doing some outreach with an inmate who often goes 3-4 months without hearing from their counsel, and my understanding is that is not at all unusual. I would love to find a way that they could address those two problems, particularly the information thing, because I just feel there's a humanity issue for people in jail getting information back. You know, if you're incarcerated, just a monthly update from your lawyer saying that there's no update would be huge. But there are dozens, perhaps hundreds of incarcerated Vermonters who are walking around just wondering when the next call will come. So are there ways that we could fix those two issues?
Matt?
Well, one of the things that we do to allocate resources within the system is while we don't deal with hours, we deal with the American Bar Association lawyer equivalent caseload standard. And those standards, people might be actually a little bit surprised. The average public defender, based on those standards, is supposed to be able to handle 400 added misdemeanors a year, or 150 added felonies a year, or 200 added other cases, which are usually probation violations, appeals, or juvenile cases. And so the allocation is actually based on a national standard. So it's based on numbers, not on time. When it comes to communication, the ethical rules require that the attorneys communicate with their clients when there's something to communicate to them. And I do agree with the caller that it would be much nicer if we were able to effectively make a courtesy call once a month or every couple months. DG's office, however, does represent 19,000 people and 22,000 cases a year. And some of those 200 plus are out of state, with very difficult to keep contact with those out of state particularly. But, you know, I don't doubt that there are some number who aren't getting the type of attention that they deserve. And I think that, you know, it's something to work on. And, you know, anytime you're dealing with a system that's kind of as big as ours, we represent 85%+ of the people in criminal court and close to 95% of the people with lawyers. So it's a pretty big endeavor.
Okay, we're going to take a brief pause here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV and be back shortly.
Spring is showing up at Waterbury Sports. Hi, this is Caleb. It's that time to get the kids geared up for spring baseball and lacrosse. Our LAC section can't be beat, with all the pads, heads, handles, and helmets for your players, big or small. Whether it's a batting helmet or a ball glove, we strive to help you get the best fit every time. Plus, don't forget to get the bike in for a tune-up before the shop fills up. Spring has arrived at Waterbury Sports, your neighborhood sporting goods store in downtown Waterbury, Vermont.
The Lamoille Valley Ford Spring Blowout Sale is on fire. Hi, it's Dan Keene here with Rick the Kid to tell you why now's the time to get yourself a really great deal at Lamoille Valley Ford.
Folks, we have kicked off April in a huge way, and massive Ford incentives and lease deals are leading the way. For instance, right now, when you trade for a brand new 2018 F-150, you can take up to $11,000 off. Or listen to these awesome two-year lease deals for qualified buyers. With just $3,900 cash or trade due at signing plus fees, you can get the all-new Ford X EcoSport for just $99 per month, or the all-new, all-aluminum 2018 F-150 for just $199 per month. And our lot at Lamoille Valley Ford is loaded with over 350 cars, trucks, and SUVs, including the largest selection of Ford F-Series in Vermont. Plus, during the spring blowout sale, every vehicle we sell will include a fresh fluid film undercoating at no charge to you.
So folks, drive Route 14, 50, or 16 to Hardwick and the last days of the spring blowout sale happening now at Lamoille Valley Ford.
Got basement problems? Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, serving Vermont and New Hampshire, is a recognized industry leader in providing insulation services, wet basement waterproofing, foundation and structural repair, and everything to do with nasty crawl spaces too. Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems in Montpelier. It's all things basement-y.
Does your driveway, sidewalk, walkway, concrete steps, or patio have problem areas where sunken concrete has caused uneven surfaces and tripping hazards? Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems is proud to be one of the only poly-level installers in northern New England. Imagine having your commercial or residential concrete slabs or sidewalk lifted, leveling your space and providing more safety while saving you time and money. That's poly-level.
To learn how to schedule your free inspection or estimate, visit northernbasements.com or call 855-DRY-TIME, 855-DRY-TIME. Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems in Montpelier.
RB Technologies on Route 14 in East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks and communication systems for their business clients since 1997. Here's a computer security tip from security engineer Dave Porcello, the latest addition to the RB Tech team.
Ransomware is a type of malware or malicious software. A lot of the software is capable of bypassing antivirus, for example, so your antivirus software might not catch it, and we've seen cases of this in the real world. It could be anybody. It's not just home users. It could be businesses. Modern ransomware actually goes out and looks for network drives across the network now in a small business or any size business, looking for other files to encrypt in a central file share. They also support cloud storage drives as well, so if you're storing stuff in the cloud, that doesn't make you exempt from this sort of attack.
The team at RB Technologies knows it's all about building lasting relationships. RBTechVT.com. When you think of business technology and communications, think of RB Technologies. Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back with our conversation with Defender General Matt Valerio this morning, keying mainly off of this Jack Sawyer case in Fairhaven that really helped to catalyze a lot of changes in the legislature this year. S-55, the background checks, the bump stock ban, the raising the age to 21 for the purchase of firearms, several measures related to imposing really Vermont's first serious gun control measures in the history of our law here in this state. And the case that triggered, I'm sorry, I'm using that word, I don't mean it as a pun or anything, but the case that prompted, let's say, prompted all of this is now really in sub jeopardy of ending up to be kind of a nothing burger compared to certainly to what it was initially when Jack Sawyer was charged with, I believe it was four felonies, any one of which could have carried life in prison. And Matt Valerio, last week I think you were in the Senate Judiciary Committee when there was some testimony from some students from Fairhaven and from the state's attorney of Rutland County, Rosemary Kennedy. And I have to acknowledge, I don't mean to poo-poo this at all, because I understand that if you are in a town like Fairhaven where you thought this might be happening, you heard about the state police affidavit that was written about this case. I don't blame you for being very upset and worried and frankly, you know, scared out of your wits on these kinds of issues. School shootings is a very serious matter and something that we don't mean to minimize to any degree whatsoever. On the other hand, we want to try to, when we're passing laws in the state of Vermont, you want to make sure that they are based on real solid factual information, and that what happened was for real. Basically, that's what it comes down to. And Matt, tell me about you mentioned a couple of other cases earlier where there's been a big reaction in the legislature to a criminal case. Do you feel like that the political reaction by Governor Phil Scott, who changed his position on gun control overnight, And by the legislature, which liberal Democratic controlled legislature, which was probably primed all along to do some of this stuff, was that an overreaction?
Well, you know, just like the people in Fairhaven who perceive themselves as being targeted by Mr. Sawyer, when the governor reads an affidavit in support of charges, he reads it as a layperson. He's not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't work in the criminal justice system on a regular basis. And he probably responds to it, my view, the same way any layperson would. You know, if you took any number, you know, take 10 lay people and grab a stack of files out of the court and read the affidavits that are in support of, you know, assault charges or sex charges or anything. The criminal justice system, when you peel back the layers of the onion, is a very ugly place.
Yeah.
If you work in it, you get a certain level of, you know, quote unquote, comfort with the way these things are written, because they're written in a way to support whatever the charges are, and you want to make sure you get all of the quote unquote worst facts together to support the charge. But as cases evolve, you know, you come to realize that those affidavits probably contained 40% of the total facts that are available about the case. And it does not surprise me in any way that the governor responded in the way that he did. It was very early on, obviously, but my guess is he read it as a layperson and responded as anybody would.
It's interesting, too, when I was thinking the other day, what if this case, the Parkland shooting and the Fairhaven case, both had broken not in February but in late May after the legislature had gone home? How would that change the picture here, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure, but you know, we have a history of sometimes having special sessions during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to the Hamlin and Savage case,
yep.
Although you know it might have been a situation where it was where the case would have been allowed to play out a little bit longer before action was taken, and maybe would have waited till January.
And I wonder though whether those intervening months might have given more time to reflect, more time for the case to unfold. I mean, imagine if it had happened in late May after legislature had gone home. And let's assume for a moment, in this sort of thought experiment, there's not a special session. You got to wait until January. And by August or September, the case against Jack Sawyer is really kind of fizzling in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Would that have ended up with a different outcome politically, legislatively?
It's actually hard to tell, you know, if the outcome wasn't what prosecutors we're hoping for, you might end up with the exact same thing. And that, you know, I think that's part of what is driving this, is that, you know, the outcome for some people is not satisfactory.
And, you know, I wonder also, in your estimation, is there any chance that there could be an opportunity for rethinking some of these new laws in coming sessions? I mean, or is the political climate such in Vermont now that these laws are on the books for good? I mean, I know there are a lot of Second Amendment advocates out there who would love to see several of these measures repealed in coming sessions. Is there any chance of anything like that happening?
Well, you know, to be perfectly frank, I don't deal with the gun issue very much. I don't think about that.
Yep.
I'm thinking about even broader issues involving, you know, 100 years of attempt law being abrogated based on a case that really isn't even a case, and you know, changes that might be made to threat laws and the like, where you get to the point where you are criminalizing thought as opposed to action, which is completely contrary to our common law tradition. Those are the things that bother me, and I think that, you know, obviously anytime the legislature can revisit something that they've done, but my experience is that once you lose a right, you don't get it back, and that's why we don't. That's why we take changes in 100 years of, you know, attempt law, for example, you know, very seriously, because I've never seen it go the other way once it's changed.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that just yesterday, the Senate actually addressed this in a bill that passed there. In the term that is being used is domestic terrorism related to this. Tell us about that.
Vermont actually, right after 9/11, passed a bunch of terrorism legislation, and most of it at the time was designed so that every state would have a terrorism statute, but Vermont could access certain law enforcement funds from the feds. It wasn't designed specifically for this kind of thing, and some of the senators believed that this might be the best way to get at the issue as opposed to fiddling too much with the attempt statute.
And this bill clearly was part of the reaction, and I'm wondering, was this necessary? I mean, in your view, this action taken yesterday in the Senate.
Yeah, I think that we do have enough criminal laws on the books to address, crimes when they occur. We tend not to be, a Minority Report kind of criminal justice system where we're trying to get crimes before they ever occur. Any of these crimes tend to respond to actions that have already been committed.
Legislation tends to react to a crime that has been committed in general, or I guess in this case, a crime that was planned or allegedly planned.
Right.
Yeah. So I do think it's a fascinating issue when we see events occur out there in society and then the reaction politically in Montpelier, it is something to watch. I think people, would you agree with this, Matt, that people just sort of need to sometimes step back, take a deep breath?
That's the way I think you should deal with probably most everything.
Okay. Well, we are about at the top of the hour. I want to thank Defender General Matt Valerio very much for joining us this morning. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
And a fascinating discussion. We'll be back after the top of the hour break with more of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back for the second hour of our program this morning. And joining us right now is one of our national correspondents. Ellen Ratner is on the phone with us. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. And the president of France is about to address the U.S. Congress at joint session. It hasn't started yet. It was supposed to start at 10, but it has not started. Also, we have just heard that President Trump will probably visit the United Kingdom in mid-July for his first state visit. Today is also World DNA Day, and it's interesting. On April 23rd, in Nature Chemistry, a magazine, they discovered that, which they thought, there were these eye motifs, they're called. They are a form of DNA, but is twisted in a knot, not a double helix, and it seems that it turns on and off DNA letters. So that's kind of interesting. That's what has been announced on World DNA Day. Actually, was announced a couple days before. Okay, the president yesterday said he said one thing about Kim Jong-un. He said he's been very open and honorable, but of course, don't forget that he called him a little rocket man at the UN speech that he gave just 6 months ago, et cetera. But he said that if he doesn't come forth, that he will walk out of the meeting. So that is kind of interesting. He said that has not been done before. He said a lot of promises have been made by North Korea over the years, but they have never been in this position. And he said, unlike past administrations, I will leave this table. I will leave the table. But I think we have a chance to do something very special. Now, this is just Ellen Ratner talking, but I think that they are interested in the Nobel Peace Prize, both of them.
I wonder, though, should they be interested in more than the Nobel Peace Prize? I mean, that is a nice, something to put on your wall. But there are some substantive issues that go beyond just a prize here, right?
Well, there are many substantive issues, but you have a talk about the fact that these are really, you know, very big issues, and that, of course, yes, but you also have very big egos. Big issues, big egos.
No doubt, no doubt. Wow. Okay, the travel ban is before the Supreme Court. What's going on with that?
Well, this is the Supreme Court is taking up many issues, and the travel ban, of course, is one of them. This is, as you know, several courts, including the Ninth Circuit, have basically said that the travel ban is not legal. That's also been done in Hawaii, and so now they knew it would go up before the Supreme Court. Also yesterday, a federal judge who was appointed by President 43 Bush, the second President Bush, in 2001, said that the DACA agreement or the DACA that had been put out, which is the Deferred Action Child Program, which is basically the Dreamers, was arbitrary and capricious as defined by the Trump administration. And so he called the program unlawful, and he's given the Homeland Security 90 days to explain their entire viewpoint on it. So that's very interesting. In addition to the fact, I mean, there's so much news going on, I don't even know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, last night there was a state dinner held. Now, this is interesting. It's the first dinner since Calvin Coolidge,
mm-hmm.
who was president from 1923 to 1929, that they did not invite the opposite political party. They had one Democrat, which was the governor of Louisiana, who is a pro-NRA guy. But other than that, the leadership was not invited. And, of course, we also know that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, did not come with his cabinet secretary wife. So that's very interesting. Also, the Iran deal turned into a pumpkin on May 12th. And the president is saying that he wants to renegotiate it. He and the president of France disagree about the Iran deal. We'll see what happens on that front. He's the president of Iran, said that President Trump has no international experience. Of course, he does have some international business experience, but he said he has no international experience. And also, the president is going to meet with the CEO of Apple today. He was invited to the state dinner, as were some billionaires, including Mr. Schwartzman from New York.
Wow. And one last thing I wanted to ask you about, what's the status of the Ronny Jackson nomination today to head up the VA?
Oh, I don't think it's going very well, believe it or not, because it is interesting. He was head of, what the president said is that what do you need this for? But then apparently he said that in his press conference yesterday. They were allowed three questions from each side. But then the president apparently met with Ronny Jackson and told him to keep fighting. So it's very unclear. But now there's a question as to whether he ran a hostile work environment. There's a lot of stuff coming out, and Congress, both sides, have put off his hearing until they do more information research.
Oh, and one more thing, if you don't mind. I just noticed you flagged for us the report from Science Daily that a new kind of DNA has been discovered. That's fascinating. What's up with that?
Right. So that is this what I just spoke about, which is today is World DNA Day, and mm-hmm. it's a twisted knot of DNA. They've always felt it was there, but they have not been seeing it, and they just saw it. So now they think it switches on and off genes in the DNA.
You know, that is really fascinating. I was reading an article recently about grasshoppers and how they are basically the same species as locusts. And obviously, I think people in the popular imagination hate locusts and like grasshoppers, and they're the same animal. But it turns out to be a matter of what's called gene expression. I wonder if this is how that's determined. If that's the mystery behind.
Well, I'm not a scientist. You're probably more of a scientist than I am. But I do remember in Washington, D.C., because locusts are every 17 years, the year that it was, the locusts came. I walked to the White House that day, and I was just covered in locusts.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. You know, you think about DNA having been discovered, just, I think, 60 years ago or so now. And 65
years ago, that's right.
65 years ago, and how much there is left to uncover in the world of science and in the world of the world that goes on around us all the time in our genes, in the wide.
That's right.
It's just amazing.
What happened, by the way, is two men got the Nobel Prize for it, but Rosalind Franklin is the one that took the photograph of the DNA. She died before she could get the Nobel Prize.
Wow. So another. I mean, people have all heard of Watson and Crick, I do believe. Rosalind Franklin, you say, is the one who also did key work here, I gather.
Absolutely, and she is considered the person who actually discovered the structure of the DNA, which allowed Crick and
Watson.
Well, I'm not blocking out his name, but you know,
yep.
Watson,
yep.
To come up with their DNA theory. But this new DNA that they've discovered is not in that structure. It's more it's a very different structure.
Yeah, we got to give the woman in that lab some credit here. Wasn't probably as much the case back in the 1950s, but boy oh boy, that is also a big change we've seen in the last 60 years and for the better, don't you think?
absolutely. Yeah, and yeah. You know, the New York Times is now trying to make this up in terms of their obituaries.
Okay. Well, that's progress is happening. It does happen out there, folks. So don't despair. Ellen Ratner, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us this morning, and I'm sure
we will be
talking soon. Have a great day. We're going to go to a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
If you're dreaming of something greater, a college degree, job skills, or technical training, serving part-time in the Army National Guard can help make your dreams a reality. Right now, the Army National Guard is offering up to a $20,000 enlistment bonus or $350 a month educational stipend to qualified candidates, as well as those with prior military service. Already received your education or are currently in school? You may be eligible for up to $50,000 in student loan repayment. These educational benefits can help you get the education you need to land the civilian career you want. Plus, as a proud member of the Guard, you'll experience the personal fulfillment of serving your community during emergencies and natural disasters. To learn more about the many benefits that come with part-time service in the Army National Guard, visit NationalGuard.com today. Sponsored by the Vermont Army National Guard, aired by the Vermont Association of Broadcasters and this station.
It's the big race giveaway going on now at your local Maplewood convenience stores in Barrie, Waterbury, South Royalton, and the Vermont Traveler Service Center in Berlin. Winning is easy. Just stop in, register, and you could win 4 passes to Thunder Road in Barrie. No purchase necessary. Winners will be announced weekly.
And now the Dr. Dale Show, where automotive techno-analysts Dale and Gardner LaRue answer some of car owners' most perplexing questions.
Greetings, radio listeners. Today we have a postcard from Maggie Z in Bloomfield. Dear Dr. Dale, my Prius seems to have a severe case of gastritis. It lurches and jerks and doesn't seem to be the eco-friendly vehicle it used to be. Can you help? Maggie, at LaRue Brothers, our transmission expertise extends to popular hybrids like the Prius and models from Honda and others.
Maggie, hybrid transmissions are complex. Our experience allows us to accurately diagnose a problem so we can repair and or rebuild. These transmissions are critical to a hybrid's successful flow of power and recharging systems.
Folks, if you are doing your best to live green and have a Prius or other hybrid that isn't behaving as it should, bring it to LaRue Brothers. We have the experience to get you back on the road contributing to a better environment.
Very green of you, Dad.
I'd be dishonest if I said I didn't miss real Vermont winters.
LaRue Brothers Transmissions. Call us at 1-800-420-4330.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, and we are expecting a visit in the not-too-distant future this morning, I hope, from 2 former mayors in central Vermont. Here they are. We have John Holler, the mayor of former mayor of Montpelier, is joining us. And I think Tom Lozon is on his way. Did he come with you, John?
We didn't come together, but we're a little turned upside down because usually he's the prompt when I'm the late one.
So we're mixing it up already here on the show this morning. That's great. And I'll let you catch your breath there for a second, John. I just wanted to thank you.
A little scramble out of the state house. Thank you, Dave. But happy to be here with you this morning.
It's sometimes tough to break away from the legislative follies over there. You're talking to people and you're... Maybe yes. You've got some testimony scheduled in front of committees.
There's a lot going on. There's a real scramble to finish up, and they're like everyone, they put things off until the last minute. So,
and
a lot happening the last few days.
One of the things I wanted to talk with you and Tom Lozon about this morning, and I guess we'll start with you since he's not quite here yet. I just got a text from him saying he's cutting it close, and so it's real close for Mayor former Mayor Lozon. Anyway, John, I wanted to ask you about local option taxes, because this is something that Barry, I guess, is on the... Here he is. Welcome. Welcome, Mayor Lozon. And we were talking about local option taxes. And by the way, do you need a minute to catch your breath there?
I'm good.
Okay.
Well, hey, great to be here with welcome, Mayor Holler again.
Welcome to the program, both of you.
Together.
This is great. So... I wanted to ask you, Barry has just voted for a local option tax. Tell us about that, Tom. What do you know?
Well, fifth or sixth or seventh time was a charm. It was something that I've always believed in, mm-hmm. and felt great about getting that passed as I stepped aside.
And it's different from Montpelier's. Your the Barry local option tax is on food and in restaurants and alcohol?
Food, alcohol, and lodging only.
Okay.
Now that's actually true same for Montpelier.
Yeah, so they're actually identical.
There's no, I thought there was just a sales tax.
No.
There was a proposal in Montpelier a few years ago to do a sales tax.
There has been one in the past that was, it's a different debate. It's more controversial. It hits obviously a broader swath of merchants, and particularly in my view, the concern is the competition that they face from the internet, and that doesn't exist, of course, with hotels and restaurants. So I think the competitive impact is really different, and I think you have to weigh the local economic cost differently when you consider imposing it on all retailers.
That's one thing the internet hasn't figured out yet, is how to feed you a meal or give you a microbrew or something,
and I don't think they ever will, thankfully. Yeah.
I don't know, virtual beer just doesn't sound like it quite has that thirst quenching quality that you want in a cold one. This is, John, tell me, when did Montpelier, do you recall when Montpelier actually enacted
its, I think it was four years ago.
4 years ago, yeah. Okay. And around that same time, there was actually talk, I thought, of a penny on the sales tax, wasn't there?
Well, there was a little discussion about it. I didn't support it. There wasn't a lot of support on the council for that. It was just a step too far. You know, ironically, some merchants were saying, well, if you're going to do this halfway, it's really unfair. You ought to do all of it. And so I think at the time, there was a view we would revisit it. And so maybe the council will in the future. I think it raises a whole host of other issues. Our, you know, merchants downtown really struggle. They, with our downtowns... it's a vibrant place, but it's relatively thin margins for retailers. They struggle. So adding a penny may not sound a lot, but they're pretty price constrained. So I think I would urge real caution in expanding it. You know, having said that, what we did enact has been very successful. We targeted it, and then I think that was the difference between prior years, where it was going to go into the general fund with a view that it would lower overall property taxes. My concern, or view at the time, was we raise enough property taxes where we should be able to pave our roads and provide general services. But with this tax, we dedicated it just to infrastructure and economic development, and that provided us with, I think, additional public support, and that's where the money's gone.
I see. Do you know how much money is raised in a typical year from this tax in Montpelier?
I think it's about $250,000.
Okay. And so and that has actually helped to keep property taxes from increasing as much as they otherwise would have?
I think I might look at it a little differently. I think we would have held property taxes down regardless. It's enabled us to put more money into infrastructure. Our roads and bridges still need a lot of work.
Yep.
Anybody knows who's driven through Montpelier. We've made a lot of progress. You know, just as a footnote, we're spending about $1 million more a year now than we were when I took office, but we're still digging out of a deep hole. So it enables us to continue to fund those, to increase spending on roads and bridges, and to pay for the Montpelier Development Corporation, which is focused on economic development. It would have been difficult to do those, or we would have had to reduce other programs. So I don't know that it's had an impact on property taxes. It enabled us to deal with some pretty specific needs that we wouldn't have been able to address.
You're talking about digging out of a deep hole. I think it might be a case of digging out of some deep potholes.
Well, that's probably
I was crossing the Granite Street Bridge this morning, and I'll tell you, that is a that's a mess.
It's distressing. Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's discouraging after the amount of money that we've spent, the focus that we've had on getting to what's called a steady state, spending what we need to maintain an adequate infrastructure. We had a real commitment with that, with the group that I joined when I joined the council and 6 years ago, and you know, we're still not there. And it's
and of course,
hopeful that the successors will keep that focus and we'll get there at some point.
Yeah. And of course, the worst part is that potholes are always the worst around town meeting day. And so you absolutely love that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, maybe that helps in some regards if you're trying to raise some revenue for fixing your local infrastructure. Tom Lozon, and by the way, I should probably properly introduce you two gentlemen. Mayor John Holler, or former Mayor John Holler, just finished up your, how many terms were you in office, John?
Three terms.
Three
years.
Terms. So, and Mayor Tom Lozon was in there even longer, right, in Barrie?
Six.
Six years altogether, too?
Six terms.
Oh, six terms. Years. Okay.
Yeah.
And those are two-year terms also? Or?
Those are two-year terms.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, so you were... You gave us a double dose.
I was a slow learner. what can I say?
Okay. So, and both of you just got done with your tenures as the as your respective city's mayors, and we now have Lucas Herring in office in Barrie. I know you were pleased with that, Tom, because
Barrie.
You were supporting Mr. Herring, and Ann Watson. Now John takes your former seat in Montpelier. One of these days, I'd like to have the two of them on the program, too. I'm hoping to reach out to them. Probably have to wait until after the school year, because during the day, Ms. Watson is a teacher at Montpelier High School, so might have to wait a little bit. But how much of the, just back to the local option tax for a minute here, Tom, how much are you expecting to raise in Barrie from this?
Our estimates were about the same as what they're raising in Montpelier, a little bit less, about $220,000.
Okay. And same sort of question I was asking John a moment ago, is this more geared toward trying to hold the line on property taxes, or is it more you're hoping to actually use the money to, I mean, steady state on property taxes, use this additional money to fix roads or bridges or other programs?
Well, by statute, that's exactly what we have to do. The city can't take that money and put it in the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started digging a little earlier than Montpelier did. We had this, you know, our communities really aren't that different. And we had the same size hole. We started digging about 9 years ago with a 10-year paving program that worked really well. But as we got towards the end of that program, we realized that it was still underfunded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm proud of the work that we did holding property taxes down. If you look at the last 5 years worth of property tax increases and you average those, we were about 1.7%. So we did a good job keeping property taxes down, but we recognized that, you know, I mean, only three things can happen with potholes. You ignore them, you raise property taxes to fix them, or you find an alternate source of revenue. And obviously, we felt that people didn't want to see property taxes go up. And so again, you know, the strategies, I'm certainly not above borrowing a good idea. So I paid attention to what Mayor Holler was doing in Montpelier and what the council was doing and what their administration was doing. And, you know, it was working in Montpelier. Passing the local options tax in Montpelier did not have a discernible effect on consumer activity in Montpelier. And so, you know, taking a page out of their playbook, we just deployed it in Barrie.
I see. Yeah. I've sometimes thought, you know, I'm a Montpelier resident myself, and I've sometimes thought the way to raise money in town, given, and John, let me ask you, actually I'll back up a bit and ask you first, pilot payments from the state, that's occasionally been the issue of some debate in over the years. Do you feel like the state is, or rather the city is being adequately compensated for hosting state government?
I do. It's... I hear that a lot, and I think it was a problem, but it has largely been fixed. The state pays, I think, about $900,000 a year to the city for its for services and payment in lieu of taxes. And that's, I don't remember the number, 80-90% of the value of those buildings. So it's a reasonable amount. I don't know who to thank for this. One of our legislators many years ago put in place a formula that enables us to get a portion of all of the rooms and meals taxes that are raised statewide. It goes into a pool that pays for pilots. So that's raised a fair amount of money and I think put us in a good position. So I think it's close enough, and I think we also have to acknowledge the fact that Montpelier benefits tremendously from having the capital in our city.
Oh, sure, and as well as all the auxiliary or ancillary state offices, state buildings, and that's actually something that Barry added during your tenure, Tom, in terms of the Department of Education, right?
We did, and that's, like Montpelier, we're happy to host them. They visit our downtown, they visit the restaurants, they visit the shops. So, for us, that relationship has worked really well.
It is kind of amazing when we think about, right here in the DEV listening area, Waterbury obviously has been had a huge relationship with state government over time. The Montpelier, for sure, being the capital, and now Barry with the Department of Education over there. How many employees are at the DOE? Do you know?
A little over 200.
Okay, so that really is an impact.
It has a significant impact.
You're going to see more people having lunch at your various eateries downtown, and obviously it would be a place where you'd stop after work at Nelson Brothers to pick up stuff at the hardware store or Aubuchon's in Barrie, and so that has a huge impact to have those state offices in your center cities. And I wanted to ask, John, I'll go to you first. We're going to take a break in a couple minutes, and then maybe listen to hear from Tom on this afterward. But give me the sort of headline version of what was your biggest accomplishment as mayor of Montpelier?
Well, I went into it really with three priorities. One was fix our roads. We've talked about that. We've talked about the challenges. I had some success in terms of funneling a ton of money into that. It's still a problem, but I think we have made a lot of progress. The second would be to maintain a sort of level growth of our property taxes. We've done that. Our property tax growth rate mm-hmm. growth has been less than the rate of inflation during the course of my tenure as mayor. And the third one is a little more challenging. That was to jumpstart some of the projects that had been stalled out for as long as 20 years.
Got it.
We can talk more, but we've made some progress, not quite. I mean, I think we'll see those come into play after.
More details after the break. How's that? We'll go to a break right now on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Here's Dave.
We are back for the last half hour of today's programs, and happy to be joined in the studio this morning by two former mayors in Central Vermont, John Holler of Montpelier, Tom Lozon of Barrie. We had to go to a break a little quickly a moment or two ago, and I wanted John to finish your thoughts about some developments that have gone on and got started in Montpelier under your watch. Tell us a little more.
Yeah, so we were talking about our priorities, and the third one was to complete two projects that have been in the works for a very long time. One is the Transit Center on Taylor Street. That has been was a bigger challenge than I thought, but it's ready to go, and I think we'll see groundbreaking this year on a new Transit Center, housing complex, bike path, new pedestrian bridge. So all the funding and the plans are now, I believe, all set and ready to go. That was a challenge, but that was a priority, and I think we're going to see that through. It'll, come under the watch of the next mayor. And the other is
let me stop you for a moment there and just ask you, when is all that going to be done?
The construction is going to start this summer, and I think it's over the next year or so.
Wow! So by 2020, downtown Montpelier, that end of it is going to look significantly different.
It's going to be an enormous change and an improvement to that part of town, which is essentially just a parking lot and a street that's in need of quite a bit of work.
And more connection between, do I understand this right, more connection between that lower end of Main Street, sort of in the Shaw's area, and that part of State Street that is along Taylor Street there. Tell us about
that. Well, that's right. There'll be a bike path that will then run from Taylor Street over to the North Branch and a new bridge, pedestrian and bike bridge, mm-hmm. that will parallel the existing railroad crossing. That will come out onto Main Street next between Shaw's and the drawing board building. So it's going to be a really nice connection, I think, allow people to circulate more downtown. There'll be more traffic, more pedestrian traffic because of 40 new housing units there. Mm-hmm. So
Wow.
It's a big improvement for that.
That is an exciting development. It's been in the works for quite a while, and it hit some bumps in the road.
A lot of challenges.
One of the developers pulled out last year, and have you found other businesses to come in?
Yes, Downstreet Housing, which is the local nonprofit, which funds affordable housing development throughout central Vermont. It's been a great partner in Montpelier, also in Barrie. Tom could talk about that. They have been responsible for most of the housing growth in Montpelier, probably central Vermont. And it goes to just the cost, the challenge of building for private developers. We tried to make that work with a private developer. The margins were just too thin for them.
Yeah. Tom, let me ask you to tell us about what you consider your, three top accomplishments as mayor in Barrie.
There were quite a few over 12 years, and we certainly, we're grateful for that. You really have to almost name them all. I mean, certainly the Big Dig, that's the Main Street reconstruction is the one that the city started discussing when I was in high school, seriously, when I was a senior. It was the first time it was a construction project.
That was just a couple of years ago, though, so, right?
Stalled for, right. I wish. That had been stalled for 30 years. So, we got that going. And, I think if I could summarize my service, I guess in one sentence, it would be what I'm most proud of is... changing attitudes about Barrie and building relationships. And, that's really what we did. And, we certainly had a lot of accomplishments. The paving program that I mentioned, the Big Dig, City Place, the Blanchard Block, Summer Street Center, certainly a lot of, infrastructure programs. But, what I'm really most proud of is the foundation that we built for the future. Because when I left office, we had grown over the last 3 years of my service, we had grown our grand list in the core downtown by 20%. That was unprecedented in 3 years. Mm-hmm. That was unprecedented in the history of the city. When I left office, home prices were up 23% year on year. Home closings were up double digit year on year.
Yep.
With all due respect to Mayor Holler here, we were outperforming Montpelier and Burlington in terms of home prices year on year and the growth. So, like I said, and I think that a lot of hard work went into that, changing attitudes about Barrie. And, every time I see a young family, move into Barrie and buy a home and put down roots, man, I would do my happy dance.
Yeah.
Because I love seeing that. And it's the future of the city. It's the future of the state. So, just changing attitudes and building relationships. John and I, it was great to work with John. John was a pleasure to work with. The work that we did on the Mayor's Coalition, I really enjoyed working with John. I enjoyed his management style and his temperament. I don't know if he enjoyed mine, but we just had a great time. Those years were really special to me.
Well, I got to jump in on that too. I'm really proud. One of the things I most enjoyed about being mayor was being part of the Mayor's Coalition, which was formed when I took office along with Mayor Weinberger. And I would say eight mayors, there were a group of four of us that I think formed the core of that, Mayor Loris and Rutland, Mayor Lozon, myself, and Mayor Weinberger, and worked closely together. We have different political views, but we all care about downtowns, about our cities, and I think that created sort of a common bond, and we got a lot done, and it was a lot of fun to work with those.
Yeah, other Montpelier mayors should take notice about how we got things done. They really should, because as John said, we were very, very different politically, but we would ignore our differences and we would not talk about them. We would look for the things where we had common ground and we would try to advance those causes. And, like John, I was proud to be a part of it, and we did a great job.
When you say that Montpelier should take notice, you mean the state government?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Local government is very different. It's really, there's just not, when partisan politics enters the council chambers, things go downhill quickly, thankfully, I didn't experience a lot of that while I served in Barrie. It was never about R's or D's or P's. It was always about how do we collectively serve everyone and how do we represent everyone and how do we just move our city forward.
I probably couldn't recite the party memberships of Montpelier City Council members. So, I'm sort of thinking most are Liberal Democrats because that's the makeup of the city politically. But by and large, are there any Republicans on the council? Do you know, John?
Yeah, I don't know. We run as nonpartisan positions.
Yeah, same.
Run with labels. But honestly, in Montpelier, I think fair to say that Most people are Democrats. We know that just from the voting patterns, and I think it's probably true for the council. I don't know if there are any Republicans on the council or not.
Yeah.
I kind of doubt it.
Or perhaps some independents or that kind of thing. But I also wanted to just check in with you, gentlemen, about housing, because there was an interesting column in this this past weekend's Times Argus. I think Dan Jones wrote it about the biggest challenge for young people moving into Vermont is housing and the price of housing and the accessibility of housing. How can we? You talked about your happy times, Mayor Lauzon, being when a young family moves into Barrie. Historically, the last 20 or 30 years, it seems like you get more house for the money in Barrie than you do in Montpelier. Has that helped?
It's absolutely helped. I mean, in this current environment, you know, we've got rising interest rates. And I would often look at, Chittenden County, for example, where a starter home was $300,000. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lot of money to a young couple starting out. Chances are they have some student loan debt, as Karen and I did when we started out. You know, unfortunately, we could buy a house for $60,000. Now, I understand that was a million years ago, but It really has changed. And I think that is why we've been successful in Barrie over the past two or three years, because comparatively, the prices were low in Barrie, or lower when you look at other communities. Unfortunately, with this 23% increase in housing prices in Barrie, we're going to see that gap close. And that's going to be a little unfortunate, because that alternative that young couples and young families had in Washington County, that's going to start, that gap is going to start to close.
Challenge in Montpelier is that the market just doesn't work. The rents don't support the cost of development, and that's the fundamental problem. So we don't see developers building new housing because they're not able to recoup their investment through either sales or rental properties. So that's why we're relying on subsidized projects that receive historic tax credits or other kind of tax credits to develop.
And when you say the cost of development, John, what are some of the costs that are proving themselves prohibitive here?
Well, I think they're just, basic building costs. But if you're a developer, you look at developing not just Montpelier, but say, you mentioned a private developer that pulled out of Montpelier. They have the option of developing anywhere in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
The amount that the return they're going to be able to get in Montpelier is going to be smaller because the average incomes are lower compared to Chittenden County. And that's the problem. The cost of development are roughly the same, but the ability of the market to absorb that cost is lower in Montpelier. And that's, I think, the challenge for our market.
And I also wonder about the cost of financing. I mean, I've owned a house in Montpelier, my wife and I have, for 26 years or so. And I look back across that period of time and the expenses of owning the house. Mm-hmm. I think we bought it for $100,500 back in 1992. Mm-hmm. And we have put probably $60,000 or so into it over time. So let's say we have $160,000 in principal in this house, and I've paid something on the order of, probably averaged over time, about $4,000 a year in property taxes. So say $120,000 over the course of this 30-year period I was figuring on just the other day, we'll pay off the mortgage at night in 2022. And but by far the biggest expense has actually been interest on the mortgage. And is there any way to, people talk all the time about how do we cut property taxes or in the general cost of housing and that sort of thing. But it seems like a big hidden cost here, or maybe not hidden because everybody pays it, is interest. What about, are there any financing options out there that can help?
I don't think on the local level. And honestly, interest rates are pretty low. I know when I first bought my house we were in D.C., the interest rates were 10 or 12%.
Yeah.
And we're now at a fraction of that. I think it's not the interest charges that are deterrent. I think it's the just the building fundamental building costs and the difficulty of land acquisition or terrain is difficult to build on.
Yeah.
We just mentioned a couple of things that we did do. One is creating a TIF district so that we can take new money and invest from. I won't go into the details of it, but it's a mechanism that enables cities to make it a little more attractive to develop. And the other is zoning. We've revamped our zoning bylaws to make our zoning laws more amenable to housing development. So hoping that's going to be more lead to developers to find Montpelier a more attractive place to invest in.
It's kind of interesting when you talk about historical interest rates.
And
you mentioned, gee, that was really our biggest expense. that's going to be a much bigger challenge going forward. I mean, we are in a rising interest rate environment. And if you look historically at the prime lending rate, you know, we were at the bottom of this trough. It was really unprecedented, you know, throughout the world and throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
We maintained a very low interest rate in the United States for quite a number of years.
Yep.
And, you know, it always makes me smile when I speak to young business people and I talk to them about developing real estate and paying 10%. And it wasn't all that long ago. It was 10 or 15 years ago that we were paying a 10% interest rate. And they look at me and say, how did you ever make it? You know, and that was normal. So I mean, my prediction is, as you see, I think we're in for a bit of a commercial real estate crisis. As you see interest rates rise, there's a lot of adjustable rate commercial mortgages out there. It's going to make it very difficult for commercial property owners to make those mortgage payments if they're over leveraged. And I watched people buy property over the past 10 years on a 6 or 7% cap rate. That just doesn't work in Vermont.
We have a caller on the line, Forbes from Corinth. Good morning, Forbes.
How are you?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Great. Barrie isn't just Barrie. Barrie also takes in all the surrounding towns. I worked for years trying to get some headway on the rebuilding of 302 between the eastern section of Vermont and Barrie so that business could be done there instead of going into Lebanon and everywhere else. That was a positive thing. But I think what bothers me more than anything, and I'd like both of you to address this, is Barrie, struggling economically, opted to go into an early release program and took some stipend money for additional law enforcement and everything else, and virtually flooded that town with people that possibly don't add to the real positive program that you're trying to put together. You created a social problem over in there, and I don't care how much money you put into that town. If you don't have a decent social environment, things aren't going to go anywhere. So I'd like you to reflect on your part in those programs.
Let's go to Tom first. All right.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'm not sure what the early release program is that you're referring to, because it isn't anything that Barrie ever opted into. I think what you're referring to is folks who are incarcerated who are either furloughed or paroled. And, you know, unfortunately, that was a decision that was made at the state level. And I can tell you straight up, it was a decision that was made, and this goes back decades. This is not Governor Scott. It was not Governor Shumlin. It was not Governor Douglas. It goes back well beyond that, where the state made the decision to furlough or parole folks who were previously incarcerated. And when they placed them, they would place them in communities, whether it was Barrie or Chittenden County or Orange County, they would place them in communities with very little consultation with municipal officials. So what we did do when I first took office and you know, working with Governor Douglas and then subsequently with Governor Shumlin, is we really focused on that number, and we worked very hard at developing a relationship with the state and having honest conversations about the effect that that was having on our community, as what I perceive was a greater percentage of folks on furlough or parole who were placed in Barrie. Fortunately, over my last 8 years in office, we were able to bring those numbers down 40%, and we developed a very good working relationship with the Department of Corrections. So, you know, I'm hopeful under Mayor Herring, and I'm sure under Mayor Herring, he will continue, he will continue that policy.
Is some of the issue here that it just happens that Barrie is the seat of a lot of state government functions that are related to the criminal justice system, the probation and parole offices for Washington County's in Barrie, right?
Well, the fact that there was a probation and parole office in Barrie, but I think more to the point, it was kind of this double-edged sword. We were just talking earlier about the blessing of having reasonably priced housing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that can be a blessing and it can be a curse. In the curse of a state, the Department of Corrections always challenged to meet budget and looking for the most economical place to house folks who are either on furlough or parole. That can sometimes be a double-edged sword. And we worked hard to make sure that we maintained a balance there.
And John, what are your thoughts on this realm? Has Montpelier been impacted by early release or furlough or that parole, probation of offenders? And
you know, honestly, it's not an issue that came to my attention while I was mayor. We mm-hmm. just don't have much of a that prison population or early discharge population in our city.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, Tom, I want to go back to you on this one just as a follow-up to Forbes' question. Mm-hmm. These folks are going to come out of the system. They need somewhere to go. Some community in Vermont or communities need to open up their doors. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, I'm glad you asked that because I was going to jump in and say, look, this is not about wanting people who are willing to make a sincere effort, people who have made a mistake. You know, they've served their time. Mm-hmm. They simply want to be a productive member of society. Those were the types of people that I welcomed in Barrie.
Sure.
However, mm-hmm. if you were someone who was interested in making a life of crime a career, yep. then I would just as soon run you out of town.
That sounds reasonable to me.
I'm pretty fair, yeah. but I can be a bit of a hard ass.
And there are cases in which you have to be that way, for sure.
Exactly.
And I wanted to ask also... Tom, you've mentioned a couple times the big dig in the downtown redevelopment, and there is a sense of that physical change that has come over Barrie in the past 10 years or so, where it does really feel renewed. But I remember when I first moved to this area 30 something years ago now, you had some really anchor retailers downtown, Homer Fitz. Mm-hmm. And what was it? Harvard Clothes, I think. We used to go shopping there.
Yeah.
What can we do to restore really strong retail to our downtowns?
You can't.
You can't.
That's a simple answer. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
If the strategy of any municipality is if they're focusing on the first floors of their downtown and they say, well, we want to see retail. Believe me, I do as well. You know, I don't know that I've ever been in a Walmart, to be honest with you. Uh-huh. I can't even remember. I know not in the past 2 or 3 years. I'm not a big box store kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I
mm-hmm.
like Nelson's Hardware. I love going to Beauvais to have them resole my loafers.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, there are some great, and we are so blessed in Barrie to have the retailers that we have. But mm-hmm. in terms of being able to be there, you know, build on that retail,
yep.
we have to protect what we have. It's going to be very difficult to build on it because Amazon is real. I mean, yeah. in case you haven't been paying attention, they're only going to get bigger. They're entering, you know, now they're entering new markets. What I said for the past 2 years while I served is that the future of Vermont's downtowns is housing. Whether it's millennials, seniors, people don't want, as my generation did, they don't want 3 acres out in the country with a white picket fence and a big lawn to mow.
Right.
They want to live life for experiences, and they want to live in a downtown where they can park their car and walk to coffee shops and walk to smaller retail shops, and they really want that sense of community. So, you know, I don't care, Barrie, Montpelier, Waterbury, any municipality in Vermont who wants to thrive and survive better be focused on housing in the downtown.
I just want to echo my support for that. That's absolutely critical. Downtowns succeed when they're vibrant and they have a lot of people who are outside, who live downtown. It's walkable, bikeable, and that's what we focused on in Montpelier. And I think downtowns are going to be under greater stress, and what we can do as municipalities is provide those amenities and make people want to be downtowns, and then retail will follow.
Occasionally, though, I still think... I mean, I guess I'm old-fashioned enough to like the idea of going into a shop and buying something as opposed to sitting at my computer screen. And, that, you know, it's where I get all my news and my emails and my texts and everything else. Mm-hmm. And you know, the idea of – I actually have had this habit in recent times of at the holidays. You know, I try to make a point of getting most or all of the Christmas presents I'm giving people – within walking distance of my house. Mm-hmm. If I can walk to get it, meaning basically downtown Montpelier, I happen to live, you know, 10 minute walk from the corner of State and Main, I'm able to walk down and go to the various shops downtown and get things that I think people will like at the holidays. And it's kind of a fun little challenge for me. And I feel like I'm helping to support the local economy and that sort of thing. But I've sometimes remarked to my wife, I've said, you know, there's nowhere downtown I could walk to get a pair, you know, a little package of BVDs,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a pair of socks, or that really basic stuff. Is there any room for that in these two downtowns?
Well, I would say, you know, I think, Dave, one of the great things about being in Montpelier is you are not unique. I think we have, you know, Pumpkins that loves to support our downtown. So mm-hmm. we do thrive in part because of that, well, maybe because solely because of that commitment that local people have to it. On the other hand, we just have to face the reality that in this day of internet access that people are going to choose to buy some purchases online, and the things you mentioned, you know, sort of clothing staples are ones that just, I think, merchants have a difficult time making that work.
Yeah.
I think it goes in cycles. I mean, I think for today, the challenge for those of us who served or those of us who are serving today, the challenge is exactly as I described. You know, going forward, I do believe in cycles and in economic cycles. And I think, you know, honestly, I think that there'll be a turning away from companies like Amazon, where people will start to, you know, they'll start to value and understand that, okay, I may pay a dollar more for that item in my local downtown, but it makes my community survive. And I think there'll be a greater recognition and appreciation for that. But for today, it's different. For today, we have to focus on housing.
And some of it is specialty stuff, too. I know if I want to get my shoes repaired, I go to Barry.
You bet you
I go to Beauvais. There's no shoe repair stop in Montpelier. Beauvais does a great job, mm-hmm. and we've been very happy with the way they've taken care of us. And then I'm there, and I stop in at the pool place to get some chalk for my basement pool table or whatever. And I stop for lunch, you know, one of the eateries on Main Street. So it can work. And obviously Montpelier has some really good specialty retailers as well. So they definitely attract folks to come downtown. We are about at the top of the hour here. This has been a fun conversation with our two former Central Vermont mayors, John Holler of Montpelier and Tom Lozon of Barrie. I want to thank you gentlemen both very much for coming by the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. And we're going to be closing up, but Bill Sayre will be following me here. He'll be sitting in the chair here representing the Ethan Allen Institute on his daily Common Sense radio program. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.